windy today.
Oh, it's Thursday.
So am I. Let's go have a drink. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. There's just no telling who might be here today as we venture in to quench our thirst. We call it our Great American Debate. We come to the discussion in the spirit of fairness and an attempt to offer something conclusive. We don't claim to be experts, but we will strive to come to the table prepared to discuss our topic. We are going to extend invitations to those we think may offer an opposing point of view, and in some cases we may extend a challenge to specific people or groups to defend their point of view. Beware, we fact-check anything that sounds questionable, and we look dimly on mere opinions that aren't based in knowledge. We are trying to reach some sort of a resolution, something that both sides can settle on as an idea worth promoting. I'm Dan.
I'm Ray.
I'm Teresa.
I'm Tom.
And today we're talking about taxes. I'm just going to launch right in with the first question that everybody is aware of, because we circulated this before the discussion, and we'll just see where we go from there. We're talking about taxes, and the question is, Joe works in a blue-collar job here in Brookings. He lives pretty much from paycheck to paycheck and has nothing in savings. Is he going to get a tax cut? If so, how much savings will he see on his tax bill? Are Joe's taxes going up under the Trump tax plan? If so, by how much? So it's, is he going to get a tax cut or is he going to get a tax increase? He's on the bottom rung of the income brackets. Anybody want to start?
According to what I found, someone that's very low on the totem pole as far as their income will get a small tax cut over what they're paying right now. There's a lot of people that have zero, they owe zero taxes. And somebody working even $10 an hour, depending on if they have a dependent, they might be paying zero taxes already. But the difference would be maybe $200, $400 a year. That's not a lot. Now, granted, that whole $200 to $400 in tax cuts that a person would get on the lower income level, they're probably going to spend it all. Instead of looking at somebody's tax cuts, what's really, I think, the best way to look at tax policy, does it drive the economy? Because that's what everyone's saying. I'm really interested to hear what everyone thinks about tax cuts and the economy and what that's going to do.
So you're, in essence, saying that since Joe doesn't pay taxes because he's way down on the bottom, it really doesn't make any difference to him whether his taxes don't go up or don't go down, as much as it depends on whether or not if the economy improves and allows him to essentially make more on his job.
Right.
Okay. I've got a graph here that came from an article on the web, and I think it's the...
Well, Dan, before we go on from that, right. Does anyone else have... What do other people think about what they've heard from the tax cuts that are proposed and what it's going to do to someone that just has an average job making, I threw out $10 an hour. It could be 15.
I heard somebody from the administration say that, I don't know if they mentioned the dollar amount, but the average person, they're saying, I don't know what that is anymore, will save about $1,000 a year. And that will allow them to redo their kitchen or buy a new car or do all kinds of wonderful things that $1,000 won't even begin to touch. But how little money do you have to be making that $1,000 a year is going to make much difference in what you spend or what you do?
Well, this graph is divided into the lowest fifth, second fifth, middle fifth, fourth fifth, and highest fifth. And it doesn't say where the income brackets are. But I'm just taking a guess here that let's say that Joe does earn enough to make a little money. And it says on the lowest fifth that the percent of change is 0.2%, which will give him an average tax cut of about $50. And that's pretty much what I remember from...
A year?
Yeah. And that's pretty much what I remember from previous tax cuts that, you know, I was never up in the upper echelons to receive a big healthy tax cut. And I remember it being somewhere around $200-$300. And I, at the time, I thought, yeah, that's nice, but it's not what I considered to be a tax cut. And yet it seems like, regardless of who's running for office, it seems like the promise is always that I will get this big, huge tax cut. And I've never seen it. So I'm that's why I asked the question, because I think that's the question Joe wants to know. Is he going to get a big tax cut? Is he going to get $1,000 if he's got a $10 an hour job? And according to this, he might get $50. And that's, you know, granted, it puts groceries on the table for tonight, but it doesn't go much further than that.
So Joe's not doing a whole lot to add to the economy anyway, as far as the money he spends. He's buying necessities. Well, we didn't, maybe I'm wrong, but it needs somebody who's significantly adding to the economy is like buying a new car once in a while and having a big screen television and spending reasonable amounts of, or fairly large amounts of money on something. Somebody that's living paycheck to paycheck, I guess if he had no taxes, it probably wouldn't significantly affect the economy.
I think at one time we had rebates, right? It seems to me like I got a check once that was a rebate for a few $100s. And
was that during the Wynn days or something?
I don't remember when it was.
I believe that was George Bush days. Do you remember that one, Tom?
No, I don't. I don't remember that one.
It was a stimulus. They were cutting taxes.
Oh, I do remember. Yeah, it was a one-time stimulus, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I remember.
To get people to spend some money, yeah.
Yeah, and I did. I took it right out and spent it.
Yeah, I remember that. It's one of the only time. Everybody needs to know I'm 86 years old, so I've seen an awful lot of different kind of tax programs over the years. But it gives me an interesting perspective on things. Let me give you an example. In 1970, in the 70s and 60s, 60s especially, and thereon, the tax rates were so high that the two men I worked for that owned the hospital arbitrarily stopped paying themselves at $35,000 a year, because to take any more pay put them in an exorbitant tax bracket, and it wasn't worth their time to do it. And so, you know, that kind of extreme happens with tax rates that are out of sync with reality. And I thought you might enjoy that story.
And during the 70s, the tax rates were pretty high.
Yes, they were.
Yeah.
They've been as high as 90%, you know, during wartime and post-war. And that is, let's talk about one thing. What do you think is a fair tax? How much tax are you willing to pay before you think they're actually using confiscatory kind of grab on your money? You know, how do you feel about that? I've listened to many wealthy men talk who were millionaires, many big millionaires, and I listen to all kind of business programs. There's about three or four of them on TV every day that I check in on and try to catch their interviews with different economists and so on. And most of them came away with this particular final thought about it. They did not want to give more than 50%, and that included state taxes as well. They were not willing to pay more than 50% of their total earnings to any kind of government. They felt like it got to be too excessive. So most of them stopped at the idea that I'd like to give 10% to my state and 40% to the government. And that combo of 50% was all they thought was really fair. What do you think of that?
I would argue that if someone is making billions off of a business in our country, they are getting, to use an economic term, excessive profits. And even, you know, Steve Jobs, he had a great idea. He built a great company. But I've also watched two documentaries on him. He was kind of a jerk. And he was ruthless. And, you know, do we want to reward bad behavior? And
it's not all about just their management style. Some people write books and make enormous money that way. And so that kind of creativity, I don't think falls into your category of ruthlessness.
Okay,
there,
no.
There are many ways to make money.
Right. And okay, so let's take a creative person that, or a movie star.
Movie
that
star.
Makes a ton of money. Or someone writes a book and it becomes a bestseller. They're making tons and tons of money. Did they work any harder writing that book than someone who wrote a little novel and worked 3 years on it? They really want to be a writer, and they made $100,000 for 3 years worth of work on a book. That's not a lot. Is that person whose book went to number one really that much better of a person? Do we want that inequality in our life and in our country? Income inequality is a big deal. And for me, when I see a very rich person complaining about their taxes, they're still very, very rich at the end of the day. And this 50,000 or 50%, I'm sorry, not 50,000, 50% rate that these multimillionaires, billionaires thought was fair to pay is kind of an arbitrary number when they're making so much. And if they really wanted to invest in their employees, they could reinvest a lot of that money. They don't have to make that much.
Well, many of them do that. You know, many of them do share that wealth and start new businesses and expand on old ones. I don't see how you can take your cookie cutter approach and make any heads or tails out of it. We're all so different, you know.
And I would say that to judge somebody in terms of whether they're a jerk or not, you know, the fact of the matter is that Steve Jobs was a real economy mover because he put out products that generated billions and billions of dollars, and that was just for him. But the companies, you know, they were making and still are making tremendous profits. And
Apple, though, has made a lot of their products overseas, and there's been a lot of reporting on that. They have gone to where they can make the most money, not what benefits this country, what benefits Apple. And I don't think it is a bad thing at all to say, okay, if you want to do that, our government, is it okay that we have this income inequality in our system? Is that okay? To the degree it is right now.
Isn't that capitalism, though?
Well, yes.
What's wrong with capitalism?
Well, the Pope said it was, the spore of the devil, I think he said.
I'm sorry, say that again.
The Pope a while back said it was not the spore. What was he?
He put it down.
The Pope.
Yeah.
As a former Catholic, I can tell you that the Catholic doctrine is very socialistic and very on the left, and always has been. So I think that he's just spouting the usual dogma that you hear from every pope.
I think it is, maybe I'm wrong, but I think what he was spouting, he was someplace in Central America or South America when he said that, and he's looking at people living in grass huts, and the other end of capitalism, they're living in Trump Tower. I think that's what he had in mind, and that people who live in a place like Trump Tower are working to keep those people down by, paying minimum wage.
I don't know how you can make that judgment.
Well, by paying minimum wages, shipping things overseas to where you can get your ties or your T-shirts or whatever made.
I agree with Teresa that I think it was really unfortunate that our tax system was so, frankly, exorbitant, especially toward corporate structures. We had the highest tax rate in the world, that we forced our corporations to go abroad and find cheaper labor and cheaper taxation and take those wonderful jobs that we used to have in this country away from us. That's the tragedy of the last 50 years. It's unbelievable.
I would argue that it was not our tax system that forced them to go overseas. They went overseas because they could. Labor was cheaper. If we changed our tax system, labor's not, it's still going to be cheaper overseas. They can just make even more money than they did. And then the money goes to Wall Street. It's all in my years of working in accounting with businesses, I have seen the income disparity happen. And I have seen the workers getting paid less and less. And the profits for the corporation, which all end up in Wall Street and people that have the money to invest them, it's out of control. Look at what Wall Street's done this week. And the growth is huge. And where is that money going? It's going to people that can afford to invest in the stock market.
And who have pension plans.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget that money gets invested. Pension gets invested in stock.
So who gets a pension plan anymore?
There aren't many of us.
No. my old job is completely gone, and it's gone to a 401k. And I was as I was watching those reports this morning, they were mentioned that people who have money in a 401k are doing really well right now. But I don't think anybody believes that this is going to stay where it is and it's going to eventually crash. And you put money in the 401k right now at high prices and may get it back at very low prices.
Well, they're saying that tax cuts are going to stimulate the economy. So I guess that we could take that, just that simple statement, and say, what in the past has stimulated the economy? And we can look at the decades, the 70s, the 80s were mostly Reagan, the 90s were mostly Clinton, 2000 was mostly Bush. And then 2010s had been Obama. And you can kind of look at the decades and you can see how the economy grew and how the income inequality gap grew. And the reality is that George H. Bush cut taxes. George W. Bush cut taxes. George W. Bush cut taxes. And it didn't really, it didn't have that effect. Spending.
Not as much as others did.
Yeah. Right. But spending by the government does have the effect of getting into the economy and going to the workers.
I disagree entirely with that statement.
Okay.
The government doesn't create jobs. I'm sorry, but they don't. Not in my book, they don't.
If the government has a program to build roads, who's going to build the roads? Those are jobs. Road builders are going to spend most of everything they make at the grocery store. There's another job. At the restaurants, there's another job. So how does the government spending money not create jobs? I
don't give the government that much credit for being able to build a road. Everything they touch tends to disintegrate. Why don't we talk about the Reagan years? When Reagan reduced the tax system considerably, we did embark, and I know people there, you can find an economist who can cherry pick this and disagree with it, but I lived through that period, and for about 20 years, we enjoyed an era of prosperity that we've never seen since.
Well, now might be a good time to interject this, which is something that I got from the Washington Post online. It's from Bruce Bartlett. The headline is, "I helped create the GOP tax myth. Trump is wrong. Tax cuts don't equal growth." And he kind of puts at the very beginning, he puts decades into perspective. And this is Bruce Bartlett, by the way, who was a domestic policy advisor to President Reagan. And what he writes is, "Four decades ago, while working for Representative Jack Kemp, I had a hand in creating the Republican tax myth. Of course, it didn't seem like a myth at the time. Taxes were rising rapidly because of inflation and bracket creep. The top tax rate was 70%. and the economy seemed trapped in stagflation with no way out. Tax cuts at that time were an appropriate remedy for the economy's ills. By the time Ronald Reagan was president, Republican tax gospel went something like this, and then he enumerates what that is. But I think more telling is the fact that Reagan raised taxes. Most people are not aware of the fact that Reagan actually raised taxes several times after 1981, and he writes, his last budget showed that as 1988, the aggregate cumulative revenue loss from the 1981 tax cut was $264 billion, and his legislated tax increases then brought about half of that back. So what he's indicating to me is that at that time, when the inflation was sky high and the top tax rate was really high, a tax cut was the appropriate tool to fix that particular problem at that time. But he's saying not now, that it's a different situation now.
Well, beyond Reagan, before him was John F. Kennedy, lowered taxes. And we had I was quite a young man at that time, about 24 years old. And I remember that it did stimulate the economy, and we all thought, and I'm a product of the Midwest, and I felt like that really did help in that era. And I even voted for that guy, the last Democrat I ever voted for.
But, Tom, you made the point that Reagan and those were the glory years, and I think that is a myth. Bruce Bartlett or Barrett that you quoted?
Bartlett.
Bartlett. Yeah. He claims that he wasn't right. It hasn't panned out. And since then, the economy in the 70s, the GDP grew at 37.2. Under Reagan in the 80s, it was 35.9%. It wasn't more. And 1980 is when income inequality in this country really started to blow up. And it has continued ever since. Another thing that went on during Reagan years, and Tom, since you thought those were the glory years, the interest rate by the Federal Reserve was cut drastically. And defense spending, you said the government doesn't create jobs, but Reagan's defense buildup and highway construction programs were huge. And so it wasn't just a tax cut. Everyone, and he raised taxes, as Dan just said. The myth that tax cuts always grow the economy and are great, it sounds good from a political standpoint. My take is that it's just a political ploy to get people to vote for congressmen or president. And I think that we need to revisit those Reagan years and really look at them and what happened. And so there were a lot of things affecting the economy then. There was a lot of government spending. So yeah, go back to tax cuts and Reagan and the glory years, because I don't buy it. convince me, please.
One of the things that Reagan did was he bankrupted the Soviet Union with our defense spending. And I do think that was a considerable accomplishment.
He bankrupted the Soviet Union by forcing them to outspend us?
It was a race to the moon.
Okay.
Yeah, it was.
Well, there was the race to the moon, and there was also the military buildup during the Cold War. And I would want to do some research to see whether if Reagan was actually the cause of that. I mean, obviously, if you're spending more than you actually have to try to compete with the Joneses, so to speak, yeah, you're going to go bankrupt. And from what I have read, that is essentially what happened, is that the Soviet Union at the time essentially went bankrupt.
Yeah, they did.
Because of they extended too much in their military, and as a result they broke apart and became Russia. So and all the satellites went back to being what they were before, and now there's the move, as far as the Russians are concerned, to basically recolonize the territories that they once had, hence Ukraine, Crimea, and so on.
the world.
That's what I remember. Yeah.
Today's world is, let's remember that all of these areas, there's many different changes that have occurred, and things were different then than they are today, you know. And today, our unhappy point of view is, for most businesses anyway, in my book, is that we have the highest tax rate in the world on business and on corporations. And I want to point out that corporate taxation is double taxation. First of all, they get taxed on their earnings, and then when they give a dividend to the stockholder who gave them the money to build that place, the stockholder has to pay again on his dividend. So there's a lot of double taxation in our system that's quite unfair, I think.
Well,
I think that what I really would love to see is I want to see that competitive rate of 20% for corporate structures, because I want to be able to compete with the world. And a 20% rate will allow us to compete with all the countries other than perhaps Ireland, which is at 12%, if you don't know that. And that's an interesting point of view, that I think if we get competitive in the whole world, and that's where we are today. We're not competitive. We need to make, I think this is much more important than personal income tax changes. This is really important to get our country back on track with building here, employing people here, and so on.
If we cut taxes a whole bunch like this, how are we building $10 billion walls and putting $1 trillion into infrastructure and I don't know what other?
Well, it's going to raise our deficit, but I want to go back to the myth that, and I do not have the facts in front of me. We do not have the highest tax rate in the world. We have a high rate. We do not have the highest.
You're saying every pundit is wrong?
No,
just talking?
No.
That's all you ever hear anymore.
No, that is all you ever hear. But you don't hear that everywhere if you really go into the facts. And we could actually stop and fact check if we want. But I will challenge that is not, we do have a high rate. We do not have the highest rate. And
well,
even if we have,
I don't
even
think that's
if
so important. Who
if we lower, okay, it isn't the highest. That is something that the pundits say.
What I'm talking about is being competitive with the world, not who's the highest. I don't give a damn who's the highest.
But
I really don't. All I care about is making this country competitive so that we can attract businesses to come back to this country and employ Americans.
What if we had
their money here?
Okay, what if we had regulation that it kept? Apple is one of our businesses. It's an American, you know, absolutely an American business. But we live in a global world. We would need, how are you going to keep Steve Jobs, well, he's not here anymore, keep Apple from producing iPads and iPhones in China? How are you going to bring those jobs back?
Give them the incentive of not overtaxing their earnings.
They aren't, it's a product that they're building over there. The profits are coming from sales in our country. So I don't see how that's going to work.
They're paying taxes over there. They have to pay taxes over there. And then when they try to re-employ that same money they made money on and bring it back here, we tax them at the rate of 35-36%. And that's unfair. That's unfair. They've already been taxed once by the country they're in. And I think this country really needs to have a tax program that doesn't overtax and is competitive with the world. And I'm not worried about what little country has the highest tax rate. It's not important. What's important is that we have tax rates for corporations that are competitive with the world, so we have at least a shot at getting people to bring an idea here and bring a plant here and employ citizens here. And
okay.
Right now we're so uncompetitive, it's not even funny.
Tom, what's uncompetitive is the fact that someone in Mexico, they $5 an hour is a big wage for them. So we can have a company. I'm going back to the labor. How are you going to keep a company from outsourcing their labor? Taxes aren't going to do it. Do you have an example of a company? Because there's a lot of myths out there. And recently I heard the term fake book instead of Facebook. We are starting to believe what the pundits tell us without going to really deep research. And it's gotten so complicated that has moved overseas and a product that they're operating over there that they would bring back if our tax rate was better.
I don't have an example of that, but as long as we have
We're told that. That's just the point. Well, we're told that, so we believe it. And I don't believe it.
If you can't accept the fact that 36% for corporate taxation is excessive, then, it's hopeless to discuss it. But it is hopeless to discuss that.
You know? Well, I just fact check the 20 highest top marginal corporate tax rates in the world. The United States is third. And to just put this in perspective, the one that's really over the top is the United Arab Emirates, and they're at 55%. Puerto Rico's at 39. They're, of course, a U.S. territory. United States is at 38.9. So they're effectively 39%. The others fall out kind of like this. Mm-hmm. Argentina, 35. The Virgin Islands, 35. India, 34. France, 34. Venezuela, 34. The worldwide average, it's stating here, is 22. So it looks like, and this is just talking about the top, of which I would have expected Germany and some of the other European countries to be in here, but they're not. But nonetheless, what I'm seeing here is that as far as the top end of it, it's in the 30s.
Well, the average is 22, though.
The average is 22, but then you also have to consider that there are a lot of these little tiny little countries in here. So here's the lowest. 20 lowest top marginal corporate tax rates in the world. Albania is 15%, Georgia 15, Ireland 12. Bulgaria is 10, and down at the very bottom of it, it looks like Uzbekistan is 7.5%. So there are those below and those above, and I would look at this and say, well, there are a lot of little countries here with lower tax rates than the United States, but I would not necessarily call them world competitive.
And it's not just taxes, it's our deficit, and tax cuts do add to the deficit. Now, the idea is that you drop taxes, you're going to stimulate the economy's going to grow, and you're going to grow your way out of your deficit. Can that work? In theory, yes. Has it worked in the last 40 years in this country? No. Clinton raised taxes, and Clinton had the best economy overall. People can go back to the glory days of Reagan, but when you look at the economy, Clinton in the 90s had a better economy than Reagan did.
Bruce Bartlett cites here the best growth in recent memory came after Bill Clinton raised taxes in the 90s. Now, this is a different time, too. He's the one who's writing on the tax myth and that, a tax cut was appropriate at the time, back because we had this massive inflation. He points out that the Clinton era, the real gross domestic product growth was higher in the 70s, 37.2% versus 35.9% for the Reagan era. So, yeah, the Reagan era was doing well up there, but the Clinton era did top it, although 37 and 35.9, they're pretty close.
Newt Gingrich helped him a great deal, by the way, accomplish that.
Reagan?
No, Clinton.
Clinton?
Yes, he did. There was a lot of bipartisan that went on during the Clinton years because he had a Republican-controlled Congress. But we aren't even close to that. That's a whole nother discussion that our government is not functioning well. And I do agree that it needs to come from both sides. Because what's happened in recent years, for quite a few, almost all major legislation ends up being one-sided, either Republican or Democrat, with almost no votes from the other side. And then there's a lot of resentment. And the next time that the other side gets control, they do the same back. So that, you know, Newt Gingrich was very helpful to Clinton, and Clinton compromised. He got beat up from the left. But I would give credit to both parties. But the reality is we raised taxes and the economy did well. I want to throw out, there's all kinds of lists, and I went and found what are the best state GDPs and the best state economies according to lots of different matrix. A lot of the same states show up on the same list as the top. Washington State, Oregon, Utah, which is definitely a red state, but they do have a fairly high tax rate. New Hampshire, Florida, Georgia, another red state. Florida could be purple. California and District of Columbia. Those are all states with high tax rates, and yet they have the strongest economies. And so shouldn't we look at our states and the ones that are doing well and try to use some of those same policies at the national level? Would that not be a good representation of what works?
I would like to see you evaluate different things like two of the states, New York, for example, and California, are welfare states. They have more people on welfare than work there. And that's and to say that they're well run is a total myth to me.
Now, when you say on welfare, we have working poor working for minimum wage, and that is corporate welfare. Because when you've got an employee at Walmart making $9 an hour, which
the average is 12 there.
Okay, $12 an hour, and they have two kids, and they still need food stamps, then what's wrong with the way that we're paying our workers in this country? You say on welfare and working. No, most people on welfare are working, but they are not making any money at all. I mean, as far as they don't even make enough to live on, so the government still gives them food stamps and health care.
Well, this is Joe, who works over here flipping burgers or whatever, who's making 12 at Walmart. We don't have one here, but nonetheless, that's Joe, and he's getting by paycheck to paycheck. And sometimes his car doesn't start, and sometimes he gets fired because he couldn't get his car to start because he doesn't have the money to keep it maintained the way that it should be. Now, you know, you could argue that he's living beyond his means. He definitely could just be off the grid and living up in the mountains in a shack somewhere and earn less. But for those of us who live in a society, I think this is the kind of discrepancy that we're talking about, that you have people who are employed trying to get by on the basics, and the basics being things like rent. Rent has a funny way of just kind of it hits a bottom, which isn't really there's no a little bit lower than a certain point in rent. And so it becomes one of those necessities by which you have to try to figure out how to put your life together in what's available. And so these are people who are living just right at the edge, if you will. They don't have anything in savings. And
I don't see how you can take the position that you want to level out everyone's income, because people have different skills and talents. And what I'd like to see is people like my neighbor. I have a neighbor who married, has a child. He works at the mill, and she works as a waitress, the wife does. And they have saved enough money to buy a house that costs $225,000. Not bad for a guy that got out of high school 2 years ago. And that's right here in old Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's got to get up and go to... And he's willing to work 12 hours a day or more if they want him to work. And they often, there's a lot of programmed overtime there. It's standard procedure. So, you know, it depends on the person a great deal. I don't see how you can level out income to, we need people need to find a entry-level job. They need to learn how to dress, how to show up on time, how to be courteous to customers. We need that. And we've always had that. We're trying to eliminate it now, but that is part of our economy. And get to, if you don't give people entry level start positions or opportunities, where are they going to go?
I'm not against an I totally agree in the work ethic, and an entry level job is, you know, I started out with entry level jobs. The problem is that our minimum wage in this country is not a livable wage. And you can't your example of your neighbor, okay, he's working 12-hour days sometimes. She's a waitress. Is she waitressing at night or mostly during the day? And he's working overtime. Who's taking care of their kids? Have they been, and has he advanced to
That's their problem.
Well,
you can't assign all the ills of the world to this issue. You know, that people have to solve their own problems.
Well, let me interject in here. We lived at a time in the 50s when the man went to work and the woman stayed home and took care of the kids and so on. And we're a long way from that. What happened?
Well, we quit raising minimum wage based on inflation because it became very toxic politically to do it. And so some wages have been pushed, kicking and screaming, because they can't get any workers. How many help wanted signs do you see in fast food restaurants? Tons.
Most of the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's look at McDonald's overall. You know, how much money they made. Or Walmart's a better example, because Walmart made tons of money. How many upper middle class people got super rich off Walmart stocks, while the workers that were making all that money for Walmart were on corporate welfare because they were getting paid such a low wage? That's why we have income inequality. I believe that people should work and that we need a strong work ethic. But when people realize that working harder isn't going to get them much, they get discouraged. They have to see the promise. And I think that we've lost a lot of that as a society. In the 50s, if you went to a job and you did a good job, you would probably stay there your whole life and you would have a pension. And times were good. People wanted to work and they were rewarded for it. And now people jump. I mean, they're laid off. Their corporate structure's changing so much that you don't have longevity in a company. You don't have a pension. And it's a whole different world. Things don't work like they did in the 50s. And I'm not for income equality. I'm not for everybody making the same. I'm not for a communist society. But Tom, how can this great country of America have such an income inequality? How can the richest country in the world not take care of the health care for our people? And you worked in healthcare,
I spent 40 years in healthcare, so I'll tell you about the nursing profession if you want to know. I think that's an interesting one, because when I first was in healthcare and learning the business, nurses were second-class citizens. Absolutely. They were paid $200 a month when they finally got their nursing diploma. And I worked in the maintenance department of a hospital and working my way through college. And I made $100, actually I made $200 more a month than they did on my starting wage. Now that kind of inequality did exist. And then nurses became scarce and hard to get. And today nurses make $100,000 a year, you know. So that problem has gotten reversed. They're no longer second class citizens, but it took many years to do that. It took, I would say, 15 years to change that old stigma that they were underpaid. And when they started making decent money. So it took about 15 years to change that equation.
And is this the old economics rule of supply and demand?
More than anything else.
Yeah.
It's supply and demand. It's also, though, a nurse today has a lot higher skill level than a nurse in the 50s.
Well, I think in the 50s they required a 4-year degree, didn't they?
No.
No?
4-year degrees is the option of the person who's getting the training. Most in the 50s, most schools were 3-year diploma training. You trained in a hospital and with some academics with it. That was the norm then.
Is that RNs? RNs are
the big universities have had 4-year programs around always, but they were pretty scarce then compared to now. There's many more 4-year programs now.
Well, you talk about RNs or LPNs? The $200 a week people.
Either
a month.
One, because they there's some old rules of thumb that really have worked, and I've watched it for years. That whatever the RN made, the LVN made 2/3 of it. And the nursing aide made 1/3 of the LVN. Third of the original equation, which was the nurse. So there are some old rules of thumb that, and this goes back to their training and their skill levels and so on. But and later on, some of us, I thought, got pretty wise to a better way. And then we started coming up with career ladders for nurses in the hospital setting, where they became specialty nurses in different areas. And they usually had a master's degree. They if they worked on it, they could get one. And we finally came up with a career ladder system for nursing that was something better than they'd ever had before. And so there's a real evolution out there on skill levels, training, and there's a lot of change happening.
As the only female at this table, I think it's interesting that a maintenance person who was a man almost always back then, still most of the time now, made more than the nurse who was almost always a female at the time. And I just thought that was interesting that you threw that out there. Uh-huh. And that still,
I thought
there is income inequality between the sexes, but it's definitely better than it used to be.
Oh, it's nothing like it used to be. But in the 50s, I was giving you my 50s experience time. And
you were progressive then because you thought that was wrong.
I thought it was very wrong, yeah.
Good
for
you.
I married one of those nurses.
Uh-oh. And you thought what she did was a lot more important than what you were doing?
I knew how important and how good she was at it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So we changed the show title to Confessions at Brookings Cafe.
Okay. That's it. Back to taxes and lowering them, because that's really what we're supposed to be talking about. I am from the state of Kansas, so I'm going to go back to my roots. Kansas Governor Brownback really wanted to tax or cut taxes. That was his big thing, and it was the great tax experiment. I lived in Oklahoma for the last 20 years, went back to Kansas often. As I was reading their newspapers when I was visiting friends and relatives, I'm like, what is going on? Kansas was always a better off state than Oklahoma, and they've had a disaster since they lowered taxes, and they've had to cut spending. It's just atrocious, and all the economists seem to agree. I did a lot of research before I came here.
Can you tell us how much they lowered them so we have some perspective? I mean, just a generality like that doesn't help us. But
you know what? I do not have that statistic. I have that they cut it in 2012 and 2013. And right now, their economy, they cut school spending so much because they cut taxes that the state Supreme Court of Kansas ordered the legislature back into session and said, you've got to provide more funding for the schools. It was that bad. I do know that Oklahoma, where I lived for the last 20 years, I did see their tax rate. And they cut theirs also, and they're having problems. It used to be 6%. They've cut it to 3%,
And they talking about state income taxes?
Yes. And they had a surplus. The economy was going well. And they're like, okay, it was that myth. It was that tax cut myth. And Oklahoma is a very red state, extremely red. And everybody was on board. Oh, yeah, let's cut taxes. Let's cut taxes. Now, their schools are suffering. And a friend of mine that's a teacher there, a lot of the districts, including her own, had to go to four-day-a-week school days to cut expenses. They did not have the money to operate. It was either get rid of a large amount of teachers, and then I don't know how you know, that's the worst for the kids, or go to a four-day school week. And then parents have to worry about daycare on that fifth day. Mm-hmm. Kids are in school for longer days. I don't think that's a good model. Do you have the numbers, Dan?
I have the magic of the internet and fact-checking.
Okay.
And
he's our fact-checker.
It went, the top income tax rate went from 6.45% to 4.9%. So that's a 2-point drop?
Well, it's a 2-point drop, but it's also about a third of a cut.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big cut from 6 point, what was it?
So the real way to look at it is that they essentially chopped it by a third.
Right, and that's what Oklahoma did too.
Well, where's management in this? Where's the management for the field of education in that state?
Who's standing up for education? Education was the fallout. The tax cut is what we're talking about. These states lowered taxes and their economies have not done well. So why not? If tax cuts help the economy and bring businesses into your state, why did those not work? They didn't work. They haven't worked in any states. The states that have...
I don't know how you can say a blanket statement like that.
Okay. Well, over and over again, what I see are states that have cut their tax rates, extremely red states. They don't have great economies. So why would we want to do that to the whole nation?
Okay. Let's do another shift here. Tom asked the question. He said that he thought that spending 40% of his income to the feds and 10% to the state seemed like a fair idea.
To the wealthy people.
To the wealthy people. Yeah. I know that I have heard that, well, in the 50s, for example, when life was supposedly so good, the top tax rate for the wealthy was 90%. Is that what you had said earlier?
At one time, it was.
Yeah.
90.
And I know that's the main reason why I didn't want to get rich. I just realized that, you know, it was a situation where the more I earned, the less I was going to have.
Yeah, remember my two brothers in California? It wouldn't take more than $35,000 a year.
Right. Right.
$36,000 a year because their taxes were too high.
Right. And anyway, I'm working on my second million now. But but nonetheless, as when I heard that, and I was probably in my 20s when I first heard that, and I said, oh, really? And it just, it really did seem like, you know, too much, just way too much for anybody to pay in taxes. And so I kind of like the idea of the 40%, 10%, but then there is the problem of the income inequality, and that's well documented. It's been going on for years. Everybody knows the old adage: the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And so this gap between the top percents and the bottom percents just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and so. It seems to me, just to throw out a crazy idea, that if we could somehow just adjust the tax rates so that those people who were living on corporate welfare, et cetera, didn't have to be burdened with the business of paying taxes. But once you got to be fairly comfortable, then, okay, yeah, you kick something into the kitty. But it seems to me like it was Mark Cuban, and it may have been somebody else who gave one of the TED Talks. And I remember what he was saying, that he was talking about more taxation for the wealthy, of which he was one of them. And essentially what he said is, you know, how many yachts can I buy? How many new cars can I buy? And he was pointing out that for the people who live on the bottom, you buy one car and you struggle to do that. Most people finance their car, and it's a major deal for them. And so his pitch was that to think that you're going to get this trickle-down effect because he's not paying taxes and he's making all of this money, and he can only buy so many cars and so many yachts and so many airplanes. He's pointing out that he's not necessarily any bigger of a consumer than anybody else.
Boy, the wealthy people I know are real consumers, and I know a lot of them.
Okay.
They buy cars like you and I buy peanuts, I'm telling you. By the way, one of the most fair methods of spreading the wealth, sharing mm-hmm. the wealth, is the used car. It's the best example of sharing the wealth out there.
Boy, I know I've bought some cars that weren't worth anything that I ever paid for them. But
well, used cars can have a lot of maintenance costs, so explain that.
Well, when the wealthy guy, or several that I know, buy as many cars as they do, they're dumping one or two cars a year on the market. And when that car becomes used, it is probably half the cost that it costs new. And that's a great way for someone to buy a darn good car that'll last them for, you know, 15 years if they want to drive it that long. By the way, today's cars are amazingly maintenance-free.
To say that a used car is going to be a lot of maintenance is not true.
Well, okay.
It depends.
It depends.
And I'm going to cite an anecdotal story here, which was
especially
mine.
Today's with the computer-assisted cars.
Yeah.
They're almost foolproof.
My sister, who was married to an attorney, the attorney made a lot of money and bought her a nice car. He bought her, Mercedes SUV. And then when she got divorced, she got enough to keep the kids in clothes and so on. But the car was a different issue because she took it in for an oil change and it was $100. She finally just turned loose of that and got a Honda because she just couldn't afford to keep the maintenance on the Mercedes. I have an issue with the idea of used cars. I've dumped a lot of money into used cars to keep them running. And we have not come to any kind of conclusions here, but we've batted this subject around. Let's end this on question number two. John is solidly middle class. He earns $100,000 a year, lives in a modest house, drives a modest car. What about him? Will he get a tax cut or a tax increase?
One of the plans is to do away with the state income tax deduction at the federal level for the person that you just mentioned. And so that is going to disproportionately affect people who live in states that have higher state income taxes. And those states tend to be blue states. I'm really 99% sure that these tax cuts are not about the economy, they're about politics.
How big a tax cut is Joe going to get? How big is he? Is it
$50?
He's going to get $50. The $100,000 guy?
No.
Oh, the $100,000 guy? No, I'm going to make a rough guess and say that he's going to get $420, somewhere in there.
$420 wouldn't do much for me. I wouldn't even notice it.
You could afford to buy me a steak dinner.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.